This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and whoever you are listening, thank you. Now, if you somehow haven't seen the amazing two-part article series entitled Caring for Two in the ICU, published in Pharmacotherapy, where have you been? It was published ahead of print, April of 2023, features a slew of notable pharmacists, notable friends of the pod, Mojda Hevner, Brooke Barlow, Grace Erdman, Carolyn McGee Bell, Anthony Hawkins. But two authors I didn't list, Melissa Thompson-Baston and Allison Langford, senior authors on part one and part two, respectively. And they were gracious enough to give a significant amount of their time going into detail on this same topic. That's correct. This is a part one in a two-part series entitled Pharmacotherapy in the Critically Ill Pregnant Patient. We will, of course, use the pharmacotherapy articles as a guide, but also let Melissa and Allie go into detail on things that might not have made it into that final publication full text. If you ever looked for information on this issue specifically, it's almost impossible. So not only do we need to give a huge shout out to all the authors, because this review article will be a tremendous resource, but then another shout out, of course, to Melissa and Allie for joining to give even more input, make it easier for the listeners to help care for this vulnerable population. So part one's going to focus on more of like ICU specific disease states and considerations for the pregnant patient. So the episode starts off, we're going to review some common PK/PD changes we see in pregnancy, discussion into medication safety. Then we go into some common ICU disease states, septic shock, ARDS, PADIS, ACLS, VTE. You know, how do we change our management, if at all, for these patients? So many amazing clinical pearls and tips and tricks here. Now, quick reminder, the 2024 March Madness bracket is going to be critical care trials this year. So the bracket will be released on Selection Sunday, which Selection Sunday this year is St. Paddy's Day, March 17th. And then voting for the listeners, for you all to ultimately choose who wins, it's going to happen on social medias, specifically Instagram and X. So follow at Pharmacy to Dose, TO to Dose. We have some amazing bracketologists coming to review the regions, give predictions. It's going to be a lot of fun. But speaking of fun, let's get back to today's episode, because Melissa and Allie start their masterclass on pharmacotherapy in the critically ill pregnant patient with part one, which starts right now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So as discussed In the intro, today's episode and special guests are based on the two article series published in the May and July pharmacotherapy issues, respectively, with a wonderful title, Caring for Two in the ICU. And just like a playoff of that, we literally are lucky to be joined by two from this paper joining us. The two senior authors, Melissa Thompson-Basson and Dr. Allison Langford, have graciously agreed to join us today, dive into these articles, and talk a little bit more about, number one, an important topic, and number two, I would say a topic that the majority of us probably know very little about, and it also makes us nervous at the same time. So Melissa Thompson-Basson is a critical care pharmacist and assistant professor in the Department of Pharmacy Practice and Science at the University of Kentucky. But maybe more importantly, I can't believe this wasn't on her guest bio sheet. I gave her a hard time for it. The first ever 2023 Preceptor of the Year Award winner for the Pharmacy to Dose Awards. And then Allie Langford is an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Maryland Medical Center, a maternal fetal medicine physician, and a critical care physician in the R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center in the Cardiac Surgery Intensive Care Unit. Hello, friends. Melissa, Allie, how are you both doing today?
Doing great, Nick. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, absolutely. Doing very well. Happy to be here.
What a long time coming. I'm excited we're finally able to do this. The listeners should know this episode has been in the works for probably, about 6 months now, give or take. I think our schedules, I mean, just from that bio alone, you hear how much these two have going on, and they squeeze this episode in. It's like a solar eclipse, our schedules lining up. So we got to take advantage of it. So let's dive right in. And ultimately, what was the goal of this two-part article? And kind of part two, how challenging was it to even find references, information to include? Were you like photocopying old journals by candlelight? Like, what was the process here?
Yeah, a lot of people ask this question, Nick. And for me personally, it came about as a collaborative discussion with some colleagues across the country, reflecting on our care for these patients during COVID and wondering, you know, knowing that there are a lot of knowledge gaps to fill and thinking like there isn't a review article that I didn't have this resource in 2020 when I needed it. And what can we create for, you know, future patients that come in, you know, pregnant patients who come into our ICUs, and how can we help, you know, providers treat them with the finesse that they deserve?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because anyone that's attempted to research any info here, it is like needle in haystack in real life form. And sometimes, like, it, you know, there's a lot of textbook references here, right? So even if you're going to a lot of your like electronic references, PubMed, what have you, you might not have been able to find some of this information that you all were able to include. So everybody, like right now, whatever you're doing, right? Not if you're driving, but everyone else, be sure to download these. So we said there's two articles. So the first article highlights pharmacotherapy considerations in the pregnant ICU patient for ICU disease states like maybe ARDS, sepsis. And then the second article describes pregnancy-related complications and pharmacotherapy considerations. So we'll be bouncing around. I may mention Article 1 and Article 2 when referencing them just for time purposes, but two great ones. We're going to go through them here. So I think we have to start PK/PD, right? So generally speaking, how does pregnancy affect PK/PD, and what's the most important change or changes, plural, that we may see from a pharmacotherapy perspective?
Yeah, this is perhaps one of the most substantial things that can apply to almost all medications for our patients. And understanding these PK/PD alterations will help us dose our patients more properly. So to dig into this, and Nick, you know, PK and PD is perhaps one of my favorite subspecialties of ICU. So I definitely nerded out on this section when writing these papers. So these patients will have increased body water by up to 50% expansion by the third trimester. Cardiac output increases around 4 weeks and peaks at 32 weeks. These changes that we see in these patients, generally they begin and peak around the third trimester, but it can take weeks to return after delivery of the baby. So 2 to 12 weeks sometimes it can take. And so it's not something that reverses immediately once the baby is delivered. There's vasodilatation to the afferent, efferent arterioles of the kidney. And so you can see a 50% increase in kidney function starting by the second trimester. There's decreased albumin production, so fewer protein binding sites for protein-bound medications. We have increased hepatic phase 1 and phase 2 metabolism. Gastric motility is interestingly decreased. And so constipation can be problematic for pregnant patients as well. So this can reduce absorption, delay time to Cmax for oral meds. Sub-Q absorption is increased due to increased vascular blood flow. And there's also increased absorption across the alveoli and respiratory absorption as well.
So, you know, you mentioned things like increased cardiac output, increased volume of distribution. You know, a lot of those things kind of make me think of that early patient in septic shock coming in critically ill. And so these are kind of synergistic, right? So they are just going to amplify and make our dosing challenges that we already know. It's just going to make them more complicated and more difficult to achieve those targets, correct?
Exactly. If you had to akin this to a patient population we see a lot in the ICU, I would give you a young septic shock patient with a traumatic brain injury and augmented renal clearance, right? So they just have like the triple whammy of augmented clearance all around and an increased volume of distribution as well.
How does then, from a medication perspective, how does teratogenicity vary across those pregnancy trimesters?
That's something that we certainly have to consider when we are advising our patients which medications to take, specifically during preconception counseling, if there's an opportunity for that, but as well as they transition from that critical period of organogenesis, which we consider, you know, to be between that 5 and 12 week mark, and then when patients transition into the second and third trimester. So certain medications which may be contraindicated in the first trimester may be completely safe in the second and third trimester, again, when we're out of that critical period of organogenesis. And some of the examples I like to use are those medications that we use for hyperthyroidism, like PTU and methimazole, which commonly we'll use PTU in the first trimester. But as soon as we hit that 12 to 14 week mark, we often transition to methimazole because we know there's an increased risk of aplasia cutis in the first trimester with imazole. So, but yet the risk of aplastic anemia and PTU sort of persists, and that's why we like to limit that in the first trimester. And similar when we're looking at things like ACE inhibitors, you know, we know that they can have different teratogenic effects depending on the trimester of exposure. So in the first trimester, they can lead to renal agenesis, but if exposed later in the second and third trimester, may lead to more like oligohydramnio. So that's definitely a really important consideration. And working with our pharmacists, specifically in these critically ill patients, because we can see critically ill obstetric patients in the first trimester and all the way up into delivery and postpartum.
Look at that. First 10 minutes of pharmacist shout out. Melissa and I didn't even ask her to do that in the beginning. So thank you for the shout out. Now, in this same realm of, I guess you'd almost say like medication safety in these high risk populations, one of the biggest things I learned is that the FDA kind of labeling that a lot of us grew up with has actually changed, embarrassingly for me, a long time ago. So how does the FDA label medications as it relates to like their safety for use in pregnancy now?
Yeah, Nick, you're not the only one who didn't realize this labeling change went into effect in 2015. So the previous labeling that we all grew up with, A, B, C, D, X, was difficult to interpret, lacked data on specifics, severity of disease. It lacked finesse, like what Ali was talking about with teratogenicity across trimesters. So it's been replaced by the PLLR system. And so this is now being used for all new drug developments, the categories of pregnancy risk, lactation risk, and reproductive risk. And so actually there's four different categories, which makes it really nice to look and see who is the patient that I'm treating and what risk category do they exist and how can I apply this medication to it. So it has the more specific categories. And again, since 2015, all drugs approved onward will have this, and they're gradually phasing in older medications and updating package inserts. So eventually we'll see this risk system for all medications. And I think the biggest difference to me as a pharmacist reading this is that it's more specific. And so how many medications had a category C? And you're like, I don't know what to do with that, you know? So it really goes into why was this a category? Why? What were the data, you know, describing and putting this into category C? Was it animal versus human data, registry data, et cetera? And so it just does a better job of helping us identify risk for our patient, you know, given their certain category of PLLR.
You made me feel better by mentioning that it's just mandated on new drugs. So that tracks. The percentage of new drugs I know since 2015 is probably on the lower side. So, okay. And I think on the surface, there are some people who might look and it's like, oh my gosh, this is so much complicated. I like the letter. But the thing is, it's not necessarily more complicated. It's just more detailed. If you like, you go for your exact patient, and you don't have to then look at, you don't have to look at the 9 things they reference to find the one article that your patient fits into. They list it all a little easier. So that was a cool highlight. I think that's one of the biggest. That was one of my biggest learning points from this is the new change. Now as we talk about drug information resources and things. All right, you all obviously worked a long time on this, used a lot of things. Let us in. What are some of your, or maybe your number one favorite kind of drug information resource for medication safety in pregnancy and even breastfeeding?
The resource that I use most frequently is going to be Micromedics, and I use ReproTox commonly. I think there's a couple great apps that you can have on your phone, like LactMed. There's also, it's called the Infant Risk Center. And those are really great references, specifically for breastfeeding patients, the LactMed and the Infant Risk, because they can quickly just tell you, you know, whether or not something is safe in breastfeeding. But I will say Micromedics has been a great resource in that, just like it talks about the differences, it gives you a very brief overview, but then you can, you know, get into the detailed information. You can review the references. It can tell you whether they're animal or human studies, which our patients really enjoy learning about as well. And I think they find a valuable resource.
I would also like to add that the Briggs Drugs in Pregnancy and Lactation through LexiComp can be very useful. And there's a website called Mother to Baby that's free and open to the public. And that has a lot of additional information as well.
So kind of a decent amount of resources is what I'm hearing from both of you, both apps, websites. I'll tell you, one of my top ones now is Article 1, Table 2, Key Considerations for Medications Used in the ICU in this article. It's a cool overview. I said this about something else. This is begging to be put in a peripheral brain. It's going to be shrunk to a sixth of its size and popped in a photo album in someone's white coat. So awesome job kind of using all those resources to come up with kind of a safe stop shop for a lot of this stuff. So let's kind of shift from some of the changes in medications and some of the things, PK/PD changes we might see. And let's kind of start talking about them being just in the ICU in general. And what are some of the most common reasons that a patient who is pregnant will be admitted to an ICU?
The most common indications, I think, for admission to the intensive care unit are generally, I think, postpartum hemorrhage, whether that is, managed medically or surgically, and the patient had a large volume resuscitation. Oftentimes we'll see patients with sepsis from multiple different etiologies, whether it's pyelonephritis and they're requiring vasopressors, ARDS from viral or bacterial pneumonia. And then we're starting to see as the prevalence of cardiomyopathies increase and hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, I would say those are the additionally two most common reasons that we have patients in the ICU.
So some of those, right, you both highlight in the article as well, are considered, right, obstetric emergencies. So explain like I'm 5. What does this term mean? Is every patient who's pregnant in the ICU considered to be an obstetric emergency? Because hand up, that is how I will think of them sometimes. But is that actually the case?
I think that's a little bit challenging. Certainly I think of an obstetric emergency as any condition that kind of necessitates immediate action in order to reduce the risk of severe maternal morbidity and mortality. So any patient that finds themselves in a higher level of care and intensive care setting, then I do consider that an obstetric emergency. But I think when we use that term, the more common things that come to mind are certainly like the postpartum hemorrhage or the crashing obstetric patient because of cardiac arrest or pulmonary embolism. But I think, you know, it is truly any condition that warrants immediate intervention, whether that's initiation of vasopressors, blood product resuscitation. There could be a number of things that fall in that category.
That's a really good point. And one of the reasons that you mentioned, let's kind of get into it a little bit and talk about sepsis, septic shock, and how does the definition or diagnosis, whatever term you want to use, how does that differ with maternal sepsis compared to the classic sepsis ICU definition that we're kind of most familiar with?
So, you know, the World Health Organization has defined maternal sepsis as life-threatening organ dysfunction due to an infection during pregnancy, childbirth, the puerperium, post-abortion, or postpartum period, which there is no, you know, sepsis 3. Essentially, the definition is used in the obstetric population. It's just looking at the etiologies, which may be an obstetric-specific etiology versus a non-obstetric etiology. But it still does use the QSOFA scoring as well as lactate in order to define sepsis and to define septic shock.
So it does use some of the same types of things, but do any of our thresholds or goals change, thinking whether it's labs, vital signs, hemodynamics, those types of things?
Yeah, there are really important considerations when you're diagnosing sepsis in a pregnant patient. So, you know, we've already talked about the large volume of distribution differences in these patients. And at the maximum, you know, these patients can gain between 5 and 35 to 40 pounds throughout their pregnancy. And so this is going to really affect in a dilutional way many of the lab markers that we use and kind of cutoffs that we're used to. So specifically, baseline bilirubin and serum creatinine are lower in pregnancy. And so if you're looking at a SOFA score, cutoffs, right, that are recommended in step 3 and whatnot, you might be missing patients with a significant increase or delta in either of those categories otherwise. Lactic acid can be a little bit higher as a baseline and as a normal part of pregnancy, especially towards the third trimester and working towards delivery. Procalcitonin levels are higher at the baseline as well. And so there's been actually a little bit of work to kind of identify procalcitonin thresholds for pregnant patients. And a cutoff of 0.25 micrograms per liter has been recommended as a cutoff to rule out infection with a specificity of 93 to 100%. So MAP as well is lower in pregnancy. You know, we look at MAP level less than 70 as a cutoff in criterion, and MAPs less than 65 and 60 are normal physiology for pregnant patients as well. So it makes it really challenging when you're comparing apples to oranges in this way.
And Allie, you highlighted as you were talking about kind of introing maternal sepsis, some of the scales that that are used in both populations, but are there unique like diagnostic either scoring system or scales that are used just in pregnancy?
There have been some proposed modified SOFA scoring for pregnancy. So specific societies such as the Society of Obstetric Medicine, Australia and New Zealand, they recommend the utilization of this obstetrically modified SOFA score, which takes into account differences in serum creatinine, as well as this lower MAP threshold. And they actually use a systolic blood pressure threshold of less than 90 as abnormal and a little bit higher of a respiratory rate greater than 25. And I think that's very valuable. You know, it's important to know that when the sepsis 3 guidelines were designed, that pregnant patients were excluded from all studies. So it is really challenging to apply these non-pregnant scoring systems to our septic obstetric patients. And just to sort of piggyback on what Melissa said with the lactate, you know, during labor specifically, lactate can be increased. So one of the things that I have found to be the most valuable when I'm considering a laboring patient that I think may be getting septic either from chorioamnionitis or even immediately postpartum from like an endometritis is really the trends in lactate, which I find to be the most important way to follow that because an absolute value of 3 during labor, again, may not be diagnostic for the obstetric patient.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. One of the things as I was, you know, looking into the article and in the sepsis section, infectious diseases side of it, it talks about how these infections are classified. It was something that was very new and unique to me. So explain a little bit about this classification and how it applies to things like empiric coverage and things like that.
In general, the infections can be divided into kind of two bigger categories, pelvic and non-pelvic / systemic infections. Which is probably new to a lot of ICU pharmacists who might be treating these patients and not necessarily used to treating a pelvic infection. The systemic infections can range from a variety of sources, similar to non-pregnant patients. So I think you're looking at similar risk factors for pneumonia, UTI, et cetera. One of the undercurrents that's really important to remember when you're evaluating these sepsis, these OB patients, is that pregnancy is an immunosuppressing condition, and these patients might be more likely to have an infection. Our thresholds should be lower for infection and treating infection. But as far as like specific sites and related to antimicrobial coverage, pelvic infection sites are commonly polymicrobial. We need to consider anaerobic coverage for anaerobic pathogens. These patients are at risk for Pseudomonas as well as other gram-negative Enterobacteriaceae. And so I would think of a broad spectrum regimen for this type of patient would look like your anti-pseudomonal beta-lactam and an anti-MRSA agent. You'd probably avoid aminoglycoside in this population, but I would have a low threshold for the broader coverage initially, whereas in a general other community-acquired sepsis patient, you might have a more narrow initial approach. And one thing it's important to keep in mind, too, when you're considering dosing, we need to get a current and accurate body weight for these patients. It's really important given the increased volumes of distribution and the effect that this has on hydrophilic medications, which are beta-lactams, and MRSA agents fit into there. So dosing off of actual body weight and getting an accurate weight is going to be very important.
Other important pillars of sepsis management, obviously IV fluids and vasopressors and septic shock. So we don't necessarily need to go through the things that are the same, but what are some important considerations or differences specifically in these patients?
It's really important to recognize the risk of all these medications on the fetus. And as we're going through, and I think as we get into some of the more specific pharmacotherapy, even throughout the rest of our conversation today, I really want our readers to start putting in their minds, you know, what is the level of evidence for this drug in a general population, and what is the risk to the fetus as it relates to this fetus's gestational age, and what is the expected benefit for mom? Because I think there's a lot that we could do as pharmacists and providers of these patients in the ICU that provides a sophisticated approach to minimizing fetal harm. So to dig into therapies for sepsis, it's important to know all vasopressors will cause vasoconstriction in the uterus. These patients need to have fetal heart rate monitoring done as a surrogate to placental perfusion. And we should be looking at this, and pharmacists need to know, okay, A, what is this? What are we looking at? And what do these numbers mean? It's actually not that complicated, right? So go find your OB colleagues and learn about it when you have a patient in the unit. We want to make sure that we're not causing fetal distress. And so while we're titrating and selecting vasopressors, we're monitoring for fetal injury in this way. Maternal sepsis is not different than kind of every other type of shock. You know, what's the drug of choice? Norepinephrine, right? So it's a preferred agent across multiple etiologies of shock, and that's still true for our pregnant patients. Vasopressin, however, should be avoided at all costs in this patient population. So I actually am a vasopressin file in general, but for this patient population, nix it from your armamentarium. It activates vasopressin V1A receptors in the uterus. It can induce contractions, preterm labor. It can also negatively impact the cardiovascular development in the fetus. And so there's a myriad of teratogenic and detrimental effects that can happen. And especially given the level of evidence for vasopressin, which I told you guys I love vasopressin, I will also grant you that the level of evidence is pretty poor. It doesn't improve any outcomes. So why would you even consider using it in a patient population where it could cause fetal harm? As far as fluids, again, as other patients, it should be individualized for the patient. Lactated Ringer's and saline are both reasonable for crystal egg resuscitation. You know, the concern for hyperchloremic fluids still applies to this patient population. So there's a lot to go into that. We aren't going to dig into those weeds today. However, it's important to know LR is incompatible with blood. And so if we have IV access issues, especially if the patient's having hemorrhage issues and getting transfusions, I think that's something to consider. I think instead of the two drugs, what we would select more, the more salient point is that the measures of fluid responsiveness are going to be altered in this patient population. And so when you're trying to understand, does this patient need more fluids, providing a passive leg raise as you would a different patient could give false negative readings, depending on the gestational age of the fetus, location of the uterus, and is it impending venous return for the patient. All of these assumptions underlie a tidal volume minimum of 8 to 10 mils per kilo, which like many of our patients don't even get that for ARDS management, right? So that's really important to recognize as well. And so many of our obstetric patients don't achieve a tidal volume of that high and aren't physically able to. So again, individualizing the therapies for these patients and have just kind of understanding the additional limitations that exist in this population is going to be really important.
And I can't stress enough how much when Melissa says that we are individualizing our fluid resuscitation, I think oftentimes we have one patient that has competing interests. You may have a laboring patient with chorioamnionitis that you're worried may be getting septic, but yet they're on oxytocin, which has certainly antidiuretic properties, or a patient with preeclampsia that is now getting sicker because they have been in labor for 2 days. They're starting to get chorioamnionitis and you want to resuscitate them, but they have endothelial injury and are at greater risk for pulmonary edema. So it truly is an individualized approach. And I think still always just following markers of end organ perfusion like urine output and lactate are going to be really important.
Individualized care, definitely important. And Melissa, I love that you shouted out the OB colleagues, because every single one that I've ever worked with or asked probably seemed very random or strange questions to them. They're always so nice, always willing to help, like help educate and teach everybody. So definitely go find they are the best. And they also know tons and tons and tons because this is their bread and butter. This is what they do. You both have hinted at it. Let's switch gears here a second and talk about another one of the most common reasons for ICU admission, acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. And in pregnancy-associated ARDS, what is our oxygenation goal? Does that change now that we have to think about oxygenation to the mother and the fetus?
Yeah, definitely. So our sort of understanding of both oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange across the placenta is critically important to understanding what our goals are and how to maintain sort of normoxia for the fetus. So our goal of treatment, we want to maintain a maternal partial pressure of oxygen greater than 70 millimeters of mercury, which will often equate to a saturation at greater than 94%. You know, I always tell my critical care colleagues that while we really, you know, strive for that oxygen saturation greater than 94%, as Melissa had alluded to, the fetal heart rate tracing is another vital sign that provides a great deal of information about the hypoxemia and acidemia status of the fetus. So as long as you've maintained moderate variability in the fetal heart rate tracing, if you have a viable fetus and have the ability to do continuous fetal monitoring, that's a great way to assess the mom to know that you are appropriately oxygenating and ventilating your pregnant mother.
So it sounds like in your most critically ill, maybe you're having challenges reaching that, you can use that heart monitor as a surrogate to kind of figure out up to a certain point where your safe range is, essentially, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, certainly we rely on that for assessing changes in mom too. Sometimes we'll see changes in the fetal heart rate monitor, you know, before we get that ABG and we know that there's an issue with ventilation.
So one of the pharmacologic treatments of ARDS itself are steroids, right? And either, you know, glucocorticoids, mineralocorticoids, what have you. But how are these agents classified in pregnancy? Can we use all of them? Are there ones that are preferred? What, from a class perspective, what does our use look like?
So Nick, I think this is one of the most fascinating things I learned while writing these papers, doing all this research. And so did you know that the placenta is the only organ that we grow and discard throughout our lifetime? And that is a metabolizing organ. And its metabolism is dependent on the gestational age of the fetus to meet the needs of the baby. And so this applies directly to corticosteroid metabolism and cortisol metabolism in the fetus. So the placenta produces both hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, which is our metabolizing enzyme, and multiple transport receptors to regulate exposure of corticosteroids to the fetus. Again, it changes throughout the gestational period. And as the fetus requires more steroid activity at certain times. And so, for example, right before birth, lung maturation is extremely important, which is why they give antenatal steroids with high glucocorticoid activity to accelerate lung maturation. So that's another time, a critical time frame for the fetus as its organ-dependent development is a requirement of cortisol metabolism. So to get back to your question, I mean, so I'm just in awe at the placenta in general. But to specific to your question, so steroids are not safe in pregnancy. Okay, they're safe for other patients in the hospital. Generally, you know, we have a lot of safety data for ARDS and sepsis and other things, COPD, all the pneumonias, right? But they're really not generally applicably safe in pregnancy. The overall risk to the fetus includes restrained fetal growth, predisposition for the infant to high blood pressure, stroke, diabetes. Specifically, hydrocortisone has been associated with cleft palate in animal models. But all this being said, we know that there are some certain ICU indications. It's really important to treat mom with corticosteroids. And so the question is, how do we do this safely? And so instead of thinking about mineral corticoid versus glucocorticoid, I want to pose a different classification system for our listeners. And whether or not this corticosteroid contains a fluorine group. So the ability of a corticosteroid to cross the placenta and exert any ill or teratogenic effect on the fetus is dependent on whether it's fluorinated. So our fluorinated steroids are dexamethasone, triamcinolone, betamethasone, and beclomethasone. Fluorinated steroids are not metabolized by the placenta, and they easily cross the placental barrier to exert any function onto the fetus, which is why beclomethasone is commonly used for antenatal steroids and lung maturation. They're also commonly used to treat fetal inflammatory disorders. And as we were doing this research, lupus, SLE patients, there's actually a lot of data looking at this from an obstetric point of view. And that's where we got a lot of our data extrapolated to other indications for steroids. So back to an ARDS patient, you know, we need to consider level of evidence for steroids and ARDS and level of evidence across different steroids. So methylprednisolone is non-fluorinated. It will get metabolized by the placenta. Methylprednisolone has a lot of data for ARDS. And I would call there's clinical equipoise between methylpred and dexamethasone in general ARDS patients. And so there's a lot of regimens studied Most of them are similar, reasonably dosed with different corticosteroid equivalents. And I would recommend methylprednisolone for ARDS in a septic shock obstetric patient. You know, we are not going to get into the limitations and the issues with the DexArd study, but, you know, there's a lot of methodological issues with these studies that are using dexamethasone as well. And there's plenty of information for our COVID patients that support methylprednisolone. So I think that is a slam dunk, if you will. I would not use dexamethasone for these patients. Now, for septic shock, it's a little bit different, right? So the majority of our data is with hydrocortisone. There's a little bit with methylpred, a little bit with dex. And I think for here, I would challenge the audience to, again, weigh the level of evidence and the actual benefit to the patient against giving hydrocortisone, which is teratogenic in animal models and crosses the placental barrier. So if it were me and I were pregnant in the ICU, please don't give me hydrocortisone. I'm not going to tell the audience what to do here. But, you know, 24 hours less of vasopressors as an expected result of giving me a steroid versus the teratogenic effects, I think that risk benefit is in the opposite direction if it were me. But that's also bringing up another great point, too, which we haven't talked about at all. I mean, Ali alluded to it a little bit earlier, but if you can bring the patient in on some of this decision making, you should. I think many of these patients are not able to make their own decisions, and their family members are, you know, healthcare surrogates at the time. But a lot of this this risk, we should be asking our moms what they think as well, especially when there's minimal clinical benefit or clinical equipoise. I think that's a reasonable approach.
And I'll just add that, you know, in collaboration with our critical care team, if the decision is made whether or not to use steroids, we certainly do advocate for the initial doses of whether we use betamethasone or dexamethasone, simply for that fetal lung maturity. You know, we know that prior to 34 weeks gestation, the administration of whether it's betamethasone and it's 12 milligrams daily times two doses, or dexamethasone 6 milligrams BID times four doses, we know that that has significant benefit for the neonate, not only for lung maturation, but reduction in risk of IVH or interventricular hemorrhage, reduction in necrotizing enterocolitis, and retinopathy of prematurity. So there are benefits definitely to that very short course of steroids. And oftentimes we'll ask our critical care colleagues that if you're going to use any steroid at all, please at least just get the first 24 or 48 hours of the betamethasone and dexamethasone, and then transition if you plan to transition to the methylprednisolone or something like that. But we do want those steroids that cross the placenta very early on.
That was also my favorite fun fact from this article. I hope you all realize that you gave like a fact for like preceptors that are just going to torture learners. Like, okay, which one of these are fluorinated? You know, there's just going to, you added another question to the steroid, to the list of questions in that perspective. But what awesome, I like not only that you highlighted having the discussion, right, patient-centered decision we should always be doing, but even more when these decisions have others involved, right? The fetus, obviously. So I thank you both for highlighting that and kind of going through how complicated of a decision it can be and how many things you have to consider in these patients. So in that same realm, right, we have our you know, patient who's pregnant, right? Maybe septic shock, ARDS, she's mechanically ventilated, clearly critically ill, right? In from thinking about sedatives and analgesics, are there risks with giving like certain agents versus others? Like, do we need a specific PAD protocol in for our pregnant patients compared to our normal ICU population?
So everything we do for these patients is going to be a risk benefit. And this ratio is going to change based on the gestational age of the fetus and whether or not the fetus is viable. Age of viability is not incredibly well defined, around 24 weeks, depending on what center you are located. And whether or not the baby is close to delivery in general, third trimester patients. The ability of medication to cross over the placenta over the course of the gestational period varies as well. And so there is not a one-size-fits-all approach to sedation management for these patients. I would send your listeners to table two of our paper number one. I think it's an incredible resource outlining a lot of the medications we're talking about today. Does it cross the placenta? Is it teratogenic? Is it safe in lactating patients, et cetera? However, given the myriad of agents we have to sedate patients, and I want us to think creatively here, I think there's plenty of room for a sophisticated approach to sedation of the pregnant patient. So I would consider these details like, does the drug cross the placenta? Is it teratogenic? And if it is teratogenic, to what organ and at what time? And it's important to note, this was mentioned a little earlier when we were talking about teratogenicity across the spectrum of gestational age, that if it, for example, if a drug is teratogenic to the kidney development, it should be avoided while kidneys are developing, but it might not be teratogenic after the kidneys are already developed, right? So that's less specific to maybe sedation, but an example of how we can utilize this information and provide a sophisticated approach. And so it can be nuanced, but these things help us understand and choose agents that facilitate therapeutic goal, minimizing risk to the fetus. This also looks like using alternative agents. You know, antihistamines are incredibly safe in pregnant patients. That's not a traditional agent we would reach for sedation, but could be something that we use as an adjunct, IV push adjunct, et cetera, and other drug classes. So specifically, I would avoid ketamine. It's been shown to have concentration-dependent neurotoxicity in animal models and human cell cultures. We also want to avoid excessive opioid use at the time of delivery, but otherwise, analgal sedation is still a preferred strategy for our pregnant patients. Presidex is an option. However, it can cause uterine contractions and fetal bradycardia. However, it's still going to be preferred to benzodiazepines. And so we're still looking at the same kind of drugs that we would use, benzodiazepine-sparing therapies, in our pregnant patients as our non-pregnant patients. GABAergic agents like propofol can affect fetal brain development. And so the goal would be to minimize prolonged sedation as much as possible. Benzodiazepines have a lot of neonatal risk, including neonatal respiratory depression, floppy baby syndrome, neonatal withdrawal syndrome. These risks are increased with dose and duration. So in general, if you can get away with a short course of sedation or shorter doses like IV push over a continuous infusion, those strategies, you know, are preferred in pregnant patients and our general patient population as well.
Thinking about that same realm, you know, we've gone from, you know, use of continuous paralytics in our normal patients to kind of intermittent PRN, just like you said, light sedation when we can. Are we able to still use that same idea or management plan in pregnant patients, or do you need to take advantage of the unique, you know, elimination properties of things like sesatricurium, where, you know, you actually do need to use the continuous infusion from a safety perspective, like medication wise?
Yeah, it's a great question. We have even less data with neuromuscular blockers in pregnancy. But what we do know is that the non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockers will cross the placenta, including sesatricurium. So pancurium has the highest rate of exposure to the fetus. We do have a little bit of data with Nimbex or sesatricurium in pregnancy, a little bit of safety data, not robust. So I would say overall, these agents should be used sparingly, at least for, especially given the data. You know, we should not be just, you know, set it and forget it with our Nimbex for 48 hours anymore in an ARDS patient. That data, that ship has sailed. And we really need to prevent that from happening to our pregnant patients. So I do agree with you. I think sesatricurium probably has the potential most robust safety data. I would reach for succinylcholine for RSI. And also you could consider like PRN dosing of rocuronium is probably better than a continuous infusion. And especially in a non-pregnant patient and in a pregnant patient as well, something you consider as well.
So, you know, the article points out that septic shock occurs more commonly than, you know, cardiogenic shock, for example. That doesn't mean, you know, this doesn't happen, right, in patients who are pregnant. So what are some common etiologies, and is this, does this specific form of shock need to be higher on our radar in a specific trimester?
Sure. That's, this is, Nick, I think one of my favorite topics to discuss. So you may have to at some point tell me to stop talking about this, but you certainly, absolutely. Cardiogenic shock, I think, certainly as an obstetrician, it's not something that you're commonly looking for by any means. We think more along the lines of your other forms of shock, whether you see hypovolemia from hemorrhage or sepsis, but certainly both cardiogenic and obstructive shock need to be on our differential so that we can appropriately, order the appropriate diagnostic testing. So the most common cause of cardiogenic shock in pregnancy is going to be peripartum cardiomyopathy. Less common causes are going to be patients that, may have a predisposition to a cardiomyopathy, whether they have a genetic abnormality that is inherited, like a TTN, and then they have the kind of exacerbation of this increase in cardiac output, which sort of allows that to present then in the pregnancy as cardiogenic shock. We can also see patients that present in cardiogenic shock from right ventricular failure. If you think about your patients, like your sickle cell patients that have acute chest syndrome and get acute RV failure. And then certainly, while not cardiogenic shock, but our massive pulmonary embolism patients that present with acute RV strain and obstructive shock. So those are sort of the things that are, come to mind when we're talking about those patients that may present hypotensive, are on the cooler side, and don't quite fit, like don't have an infectious etiology.
So, the article goes into detail about how your treatment's going to be individualized based on, those patient specific factors that you all have talked about. So, if you need a vasodilator, vasoconstrictor, what have you, but are there specific medications to avoid in the acute setting, like vasoactives, vasopressors, inotropes, or vasodilators?
Yeah, that, certainly I think some of the considerations that I have when I'm approaching a patient in cardiogenic shock is certainly the gestational age. And, do I think I can potentially bridge this patient, whether it's with inotropic support, vasopressor support, potentially even mechanical support, whether we're using an Impella or a balloon pump or ECMO, to a further gestational age? We've had patients that come in at 24 weeks in cardiogenic shock. And, we certainly want to try to get that patient to 28 or even 32 weeks if we can safely do that. So my inotrope of choice depends, again, on the clinical presentation and gestational age. And while I love epinephrine, it can certainly have adverse effects such as contractions. Thinking about milrinone or dobutamine, whether your patient presents with arrhythmias, whether their blood pressure can tolerate it. I will say that I have, over the past couple of years, and had more exposure to patients in cardiogenic shock in pregnancy. And honestly, I favored milrinone. Just because, again, I find that my patients can tolerate it for prolonged periods of time. But also, I will say that I have learned the hard way that when I take a patient to surgery for their C-section and they've been on milrinone, that the bleeding and the profound vasodilation that we encounter can be problematic. So I think it's really important to consider all of those things. How is this patient going to deliver? Do you anticipate a large volume of hemorrhage? Are we remote from delivery where we can use milrinone and then potentially transition to epinephrine intraoperatively? And then for vasopressors, the same thing, norepinephrine as the first choice.
I think everyone listening to you right now is thinking the exact same thing as me. You are like one of that you every patient that you get to treat is unbelievably lucky. All the things that you have to consider and think about, because that's probably just a very acute snapshot, right? One acute organ system and not even all of it. So that's so cool. You just had to be sure to know that, because that's what the listeners are thinking right now as well. Now, what kind of other classic acute care cardiac pharmacotherapy things should we preferentially avoid in this population? I know there's going to be some sad critical care folks when you go through some of the things that we can't use in this population.
I would send your your listeners back to table two of our paper. That is going to become my new pocket reference for my next pregnant patient. But a couple of the big ones. So nitroprusside is out. I don't know how many people are in love with nitroprusside.
Feels like that's out anyways, really well. Right?
Oh yeah, I know, right? So, you know, don't use that. You can't use amiodarone for these patients. So we use that like water in my MICU. So that is kind of problematic for us.
That's what I was hinting at for sure. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, the amiodarone beta blocker debate ensues, right? Trying to figure out a way to treat these arrhythmias without harming our babies. It's teratogenic to the thyroid and it can restrict growth. So it's just got a bunch of problems with it. As far as beta blockers, you know, we kind of highlighted that atenolol does cross the placental barrier, not recommended in pregnancy. So it's hard to go through every single drug you might be able to use, but as a pharmacist treating a patient, I think it's our job to double check. You know, a lot of the, again, the risks of pregnancy are linked through your Micromedics and LexiComp software. And so, you know, you're reaching for your ESMO. Why don't you go ahead and double check that? Because there might be an alternative that's safer that we're not even realizing.
Yeah, you hit on the big pieces. And FYI, I feel like I look up everything. I've even looked up Tylenol before, right? If in doubt, you just never know. In the severe cases in these patients, right, that we're truly trying to avoid, right, cardiac arrest, talk us through what changes. Do our compressions, pharmacotherapy, does any of the classic algorithm we think about change in this scenario?
You know, and while this is probably one of the scariest scenarios, you know, that nobody really ever wants to find themselves in, the fundamentals of ACLS in pregnancy do not change. The biggest caveat and kind of asterisk that I will say is please, please, please don't forget about left uterine displacement. You know, we don't ever want to put a wedge under our pregnant patient when we're doing chest compressions, because we know that that can decrease the efficacy of our chest compressions. But the rate, certainly the depth, and your administration of all medications, epinephrine, any antiarrhythmics, are perfectly reasonable, safe, and the same doses are used. And I know things like, you know, we did say amiodarone is unsafe, but again, that's more prolonged use. So if you're using it once or twice in the setting of cardiac arrest or, you know, and if you have to use lidocaine, those things are okay to use in the setting of ACLS, but everything else is going to be the same.
You know, you mentioned that's obviously one of the scariest things. And I think in this patient population, a lot of times mechanical circulatory support and some of those things might get thought about or possibly implemented earlier. So talk us through, because I think a lot of people who work at some of the critical care hospitals that maybe aren't in OBICU, the patients that they may see may be those who are cannulated for ECMO, for example. So is this one of the scenarios where you would do that before? Kind of talk us through that thought process of mechanical circulatory support.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the, certainly one of the things that I think of when I have a critically ill obstetric patient, or even, you know, patients unfortunately experience cardiac arrest on a labor floor that don't necessarily have all the warning signs in time for escalation of care to an intensive care unit. So I do encourage listeners, I encourage and I teach all of the residents and fellows that if you have a pregnant patient that experiences cardiac arrest, regardless of the etiology, you should activate your, if you have a ECPR team available at your institution, it's better to activate that team, have them come to the bedside and also assess the patient. You know, some of the causes of cardiac arrest in pregnancy, you can think of massive pulmonary embolism. We think of amniotic fluid embolism. Both associated with right ventricular failure can be supported with mechanical support and ECMO. So we also, you know, this isn't really as much pharmacotherapy, but we always keep in mind the idea of a resuscitative hysterotomy after 20 weeks gestation. So, you know, if that is not effective in itself when delivering the fetus, or what we used to call a perimortem cesarean delivery, then definitely considering ECMO to support that patient while you're working through your differential.
You know, you mentioned acute pulmonary embolism, right, is one of the things that could cause cardiogenic shock and things. And, you know, the article highlights, I didn't actually know this, is the most common cause of pregnancy-related death. So when we're thinking of treatment of that, this is one of the patient populations that I always think of one specific drug class, right? And it is our low molecular weight heparins. So is this still our workhorse? Or have we kind of shifted to maybe using DOACs or some other agent of choice?
Only safe anticoagulants in pregnancy are still the low molecular weight heparin and oxygenated heparins. Unfortunately, DOACs, direct thrombin inhibitors, warfarin, all across the placental barrier can exert anticoagulant effects into the fetus. DOACs specifically have been associated with increased rates of miscarriage, craniofacial abnormalities. So no, unfortunately, we can't use those for this population. Lovenox is still going to be the drug of choice. And if your patient requires continuous therapeutic anticoagulation in your ICU, even including ECMO indications or otherwise, you know, unfractionated heparin is going to be the safest option.
I'm not going to spoil it because I want the listeners to go look at it, but there's great pearls about once versus twice daily dosing in there, talking about peaks and things. So you should go look to find the answer if we can use one versus the other. Now, I don't mean for this to be a hot topic, but I feel like anytime you talk about anti-10A monitoring, there are some people that just feel really strongly one way or the other. But my question is being pregnant alone an indication for anti-10A monitoring? Like, is this something that gets monitored for all of those patients, or are we still looking for those classic risk factors like renal dysfunction or body weight extremes?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I'm afraid I probably don't have a very black and white answer for you. This area has much less research available than I feel like it should. So the guidelines do not necessarily recommend routine 10A monitoring. There's possible indications for increased or thoughts that these patients need increased dose due to increased renal clearance. But you're alluding to the pearls that we discussed in the paper, and that basically comes from a large pharmacokinetic study done in the United Kingdom. That looked at C peak and C trough monitoring on once daily and twice daily enoxaparin. So this paper suggests that the once daily pharmacokinetic profile is actually preferred, and that 10A monitoring is not needed for routine patients outside of the extremes of weight, renal dysfunction, the classical indications you would think of in a normal non-pregnant population to monitor. The guidelines do, however, recommend monitoring for patients who are being anticoagulated for mechanical valves. So I think if you're to monitor and adjust off of 10A levels, you might consider what the trough is as well. And so that PK study was quite interesting. You know, generally when you check a 10A, it's 4 hours after your dose, right? You're looking for peak level in the therapeutic range. But what they found was that when they achieved the desired peak level, they had elevated trough levels as well. So it's something to consider. When you're going to be monitoring the peak levels, if you're making dose adjustments off of this, you might want to catch a trough and see what that is. And I don't have the exact recommendations for you here, but ideally you're treating these patients in collaboration with experts, and you all can make an patient-informed decision about safety and efficacy as well. But yeah, it's not as clear-cut as we would like it to be, for sure.
It never is, unfortunately. And also, look at you being the best teacher and giving them, that's one of those where like you asked a question on the test and the answer you found in a later question. So shout out to you for that little Easter egg, because that's what I was hinting at. You're exactly right. In this same kind of anticoagulation realm, the last kind of pharmacotherapy that I think of, right, for like acute PEs, thrombolytic agents. So are they indicated for high risk or massive PEs? Do we only consider them if it's a true cardiac risk? What are our thoughts on using thrombolytics in these patients?
I think I'm going to have to echo Melissa on this one and just say that unfortunately it's not black and white, and there are many clinical scenarios that I think this is, it certainly is considered. You know, The worst case scenario that I think of, and we simulate this with our critical care fellows actually, is a patient that's, 30 weeks in the ICU that has a cardiac arrest because of a pulmonary embolism, that you are considering this perimortem C-section or resuscitative hysterotomy, but also then considering, do we push thrombolytics? Because we know that in all other patients that have any type of surgical procedure, that that's going to be contraindicated. So, I've had scenarios that go both ways, that a patient received thrombolytics and unfortunately had hemorrhage that we were unable to stop. And I've had patients that we withheld thrombolytics and activated our ECMO team. So I think it depends on the institution. I think it depends on how rapidly you can mobilize ECMO if that's what you're considering. I think it depends on gestational age. If you're in the first trimester and you're not going to do any procedure, such as a C-section, then I would say absolutely my threshold to administer thrombolytics would be much, much lower. But if I'm in the third trimester and I'm truly considering a C-section, then, perhaps you could, my thought process is perform the resuscitative hysterotomy. If you don't get, return of spontaneous circulation and you don't have ECMO readily available, then I would consider thrombolytics in that scenario. But I would first see if within those first 4 minutes, maybe while pharmacy is getting the medication available, if that alone is enough to obtain ROSC. And if not, then, the alternative, unfortunately, is a maternal death. So you could consider thrombolytics in that scenario.
Okay, part one in the books. Now we recorded this all at once, so they'll get their appropriate send-off for part two, of course. But have to give a huge, huge thanks, right? Melissa Thompson Baston at MT Baston. If you want to reach out to her on social media, and Dr. Allison or Allie Langford. Just incredible wealths of knowledge. Wow, this has already been unbelievable, and this is just part one. So let me know what you think at Pharmacy to Dose, TO to Dose on social media. Reminder, right? 2024 March Madness bracket is coming. So follow so you're up to date on all those things there. Come to the website, pharmacytodose.com, or via email, right? If you want to shoot me a message, pharmacytodose@gmail.com. But until next time, I'm Nick Peters. This is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guest and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.